I live mostly for the past now. Thinking about it. Rewinding it, studying it. I reckon it's the best place to be because the present is too fucking boring to be going on with. And the future you've no control over. But with the past, it's different. It's kind of like a dream. A waking dream that you can walk around and manhandle and pore over. And you can reconstruct it in about 100 different ways. I've started doing a diploma in history and archaeology since I got here. And the one thing that really shocked me about my course was finding out that history was so hazy. Even historians argue about where the truth lies, or if there is a truth. And of course there isn't, because the past is like the present in a way. It's full of little liars. And facts can't be relied on. And anyway, any book on history is just a version of what happened. And you know that out there are about 5 or 6 other versions that are all completely different. And I found out pretty quick that my diploma isn't like the history I learnt at school. A long list of dates and score sheets and massacres that the Brits done on us. But what the examiners are after, your opinions of the people involved in the things that they'd done. It's a very interesting way to look at things. It's like, history is mad, really, when you think about it. It's written backwards. It starts at the end and it tries to join up all these dots all the way back to the beginning. If you ask me to make an arse of it most of the time. I mean, it's the only subject in all of learning where you get to start with the answers and you get to make up the questions. It occurred to me early on that historians are missing something huge in their studies. I mean, if they got it right, then history would be like, oh, what's the word now? It means the word that's spelled the same backwards and forwards? Ah, I forget what the word is anyway. But that's what history would be like if they were right. Cause and effect moving like cogs together in a faultless logic machine, and there'd be never no doubt about nothing. And everything would be grand, moving forward with certainty. Only history's not like that. And it's not like that because of us. So I've started to put a theory together to explain all this. Why history is nearly always wrong. Right. There are actually two types of history, if you ask me. The first is what I call big history, the men involved and the big events and the scores and the killings and the massacres. And of course, all that's in the books, like big stories, bombs and battles and charges and retreats and all that old shite. And that's great, like. But then there's the other kind of history, the secret history. The history of all the small things that happen in your life. A drunken dance. A dress that made you feel good about yourself. A rainy day, a sunny day, the colour of your buttons. Or whatever. And all these secret histories, everyone walks around in them every day inside them. It's like their internal history DNA, and it's what makes them who they are, and it's the reason for what they do. But it's like historians have forgotten this. I mean, secret history isn't even talked about, but you see, secret history is like the muscles and the bones of the past. Big history is only the old skin and hair and nails. And that's why the past is so full of holes. Forgotten secret history. It's a known fact that you could put together the major events of a man's life, like his times and dates and all that, and you still wouldn't have a likeness. Without his secret history, he's just a body without a skeleton lumping. Our secret history is who we are. And our secret history is why we do things. So I'm going to give you the two versions of myself and then let you make up your own minds. Here goes. My big history. I lived in the arsehole of nowhere and mostly did nothing with my life. I was taught by nuns and learned fuck all. And then spent 11 years in a factory making widgets until it closed down. And after that, well, I was married. In a manner of speaking. Until I attempted to kill my husband by stabbing him through the top of the head with a carving knife. But he survived. To the silver bullet I should have used, I reckon, or a stake in the heart. But, well, that's neither here nor there. And I occasioned him actual bodily harm, and he's still in hospital, but he's on the mend, or so I've been told. And he keeps getting the nurses to send me letters for him, but I don't reply or hardly even read them. And I was tried and found guilty by a group of my peers, as the man says, and I was sent down for 6 years. The papers, of course, had a field day. All witch or gaol or black widow. They told lies about me, saying I was a whore. I had more fancy men than hot dinners, that I was an alcoholic and all sorts. They kept saying, oh, I had no children. Childless. Barren. As if that made me a bad person. Then one day, one of the photographers shouted out that I was a twisted fucker in front of everyone, like, and I went for him. They all snapped away and laughed their holes off. And in the end, it took 3 Vanguarder to restrain me. And that's where that photo came from. But they never explained that in the papers the next day. Only said that I was mad and bad and printed the photo as proof. And it's what most people believe now. And that's that. My big history. My secret history now takes a bit longer to tell. But I'll bounce through it in stages and save you the boring bits. The first part of my secret history is the landscape around where we lived. Now they say, whoever the fuck they are, that a landscape affects people in ways that they don't even know yet, like accent, outlook, temperament, all that shite. Well, if that's true, God help the people brought up around where I lived. No mountains or valleys or cliffs or beautiful rocks or nothing. We didn't have a landscape. Just flat, dirty bog and a few furze bushes. Or if you were really lucky, the odd bit of heather. And then some half-bald pine trees grown behind fences as an investment. I mean, no trees for tree's sake. Money trees. Horrible yokes grown to make cheap furniture. And filthy lakes. Ponds, really, that were only used by the kids to get pissed alongside after they'd been barred from the pubs in town or else to breed nippy little insects in the hot weather. And when they drove me to Dublin, after the shit hit the fan in the squad car, like, it was as if a veil had been taken from in front of my eyes and I could see the whole stinking Midlands for what it was. Dirty and grey and slimy, smelly old hole. Pylons. Water towers and mental hospitals. Not one building you could be proud of. Occasionally we'd be passing through some old town or other and I'd see some little girl on the side of the road or on the footpath just staring at the car. And sometimes half waving or something, but mostly just staring. And I'd touch the window of the car with my finger and I'd pretend I was drawn on the condensation, but really in my head, like, I was pointing at her saying, that's me. Up until the point when I started throwing shot, but I think that had been my biggest occupation. Staring. Goggle-eyed. Watching cars whiz by and thinking, even though I've been told a million times not to take a lift from strangers, if a car stopped and offered to drive me away from this shithole, even if it had been a priest driving, I'd have been in like Flynn. No one ever did stop, though. More's the pity. Even the house where we lived, me and Red, like, it looked blind or something, like not the full shilling. And when I wasn't harbouring thoughts of kicking every last brick of it to the ground, I used to feel sorry for it. Stupid way to feel about a house, I know, but you're... And there was a field around the house that used to float when it drizzled. Sometimes the house just looked like it was floating there. Lost. Like the rest of us, I suppose. And it appeared that we had every telephone pole and pylon within a 5 mile radius stuck in our front garden and the hedges around. And none of them stood up straight. Oh, it looked like most of them were gee-eyed. And we had about 90 heavy-duty cables passing overhead. I reckon me and Red were being slowly fried. And on warm days, it felt like everything was humming. Chairs and plates and pitchers and lamps. Sure, I could even feel it in my fillings. Over to the left of the house, then, was the factory where I worked for years and the machines. To the right was some old ESB building that no one ever went near but made weird noises at night. It was covered in signs that said, "Danger, keep out." Behind us was a water tower, and in front was nothing but a huge sign that said, "Dumping prohibited." And then only the horizon. Honest to God, I'm not joking you. There were days when I felt like I'd just been dropped onto the place. That it was none of me. And we were downwind of the abattoir. I reckon 'twas the only place in Ireland, or in God's earth for that matter, that looked 10 times worse when the sun shone. And people wonder why I stabbed someone. Really? It's a wonder I didn't set fire to the whole fucking town. You see, I think historians and archaeologists, they look at the wrong things when they're putting together the history of a past or of a town or whatever. I mean, off they'd be looking at pots or coins or jewellery. When all they have to do is take a good look around them at the landscape, they'd have a good half their stories told. I mean, we are our landscapes. I saw a gas on there the other day. I was watching a video for the course and it was about some fully preserved Egypt or other that they'd pulled from some bog hole near Athlone into which they'd fallen about 1,000 years previous. And it was a she and they called her Maeve or some old shite like that. Anyway, the expert on the video was going on about how important this find was and how we had so much to learn from Maeve and how we could get such a clear picture about what people were like back then, like what they wore, what the average height was, all that old shite. And according to a man and his one body, the ancient Irish were all short-arsed, red-haired, buck-teethed, bow-legged turnip-eaters. As I sat there, I thought, now, hold on here a minute. You are building a huge picture about the way life was by studying the body of the boy or the girl from the townland who fell in the bog hole. I mean, maybe if it was piles of bodies you were finding down bog holes, you might be onto something. You could get away with all the short-arsed, blah, blah, turnip shite that you liked. But it cast aspersions on a whole race because the town loon fell in a hole and died. Seems a bit too much to me. I mean, science me arse. Ordinary people don't fall in holes. People like me, big girls, we don't fall in holes. In fact, if you were to look at the kind of person who was most likely to fall into a hole these days, you'd probably find that it was a short girl with red hair and buck teeth who eats turnips and who's called Maeve. No change ever. People are and always will be the same, if you ask me. The only things that changes are the buildings and the machines and the governments. And the things that keep us going now are the same things that have kept everyone going forever. Jealousy. And loneliness. And fear of the future. Our secret histories. Part two of my secret history is my best friend, Kathleen Cody. Me and Kathleen did everything together. And up until the point when I started throwing shot put and she started going out with Walter, we were pretty much inseparable. I remember well the day I met her. I don't know why exactly, but the scene is kind of burnt in my mind. And the colours are exactly like colours you'd see in an old family photo or a postcard of Galway. Ah, maybe that's just the way colour looked back then. I don't know. Anyway, I was outside playing with some crazy old doll. And not being the kind of girl to play with dollies, I was baiting its head off the ground repeatedly. And I could hear music drifting from some window somewhere. Now, I was in my bare feet. My toes had been given a lick of nail varnish, maybe by an aunt or something. I was really young now, like 5 or something. I had this cardigan on, it was green. And the buttons in it were in the shape of ducks. Duck buttons. And I don't know why exactly. But sometimes when I think about those buttons, I just want to cry my eyes out. I don't know why, I really don't, because it's not like they were the most beautiful things I'd ever seen or anything. But sure. So there I am, hammering away old crazy doll's head in the ground. And I looked up, and there she was in front of me. Kathleen Cody. And we stayed stuck, still for the longest time. Not knowing whether to burst out crying or not. And then I hear a voice behind me saying, "That's your little friend now." And so be it. Within about half an hour, we're rolling on the ground, screaming and scratching and pinching each other in a fight to the death over Crazy Doll. Best friends. We were dangerous to be around. I mean, even the nuns were afraid of us. And we got blamed for everything. Fair enough, I reckon, since we did about 75% of it. And we probably made more girls cry than any man could ever dream of. We were wild. And we become blood sisters from about the age of 13 because of some shite Yankee film we'd seen it happening. And we talked all the time of getting out of this old hole and going to England, probably. And we'd live in Leeds, maybe. And we'd have boyfriends and not husbands. And when we had babies, they could look after them so that me and Kathleen could go out in the piss. And we promised each other that if we ever did get married, we'd be each other's bridesmaids. And so we left school together after the inter, got jobs in the factory, started going to dances and drinking a bit, and slowly it happened, we just stopped laughing so much. And then Kathleen started going out with Walter, and I pulled away a bit. Walter was a long old drink of water. He'd no bit of fun in him, no bit of crack. If you hung around at him too long, it was as if the world turned black and white, and to tell you the truth, I could have strangled the bastard. And then one day, Kathleen announces that her and Walter were immigrating to Birmingham, to where his older brother was. We had a fantastic send-off for them. There was dancing and laughing and crying. And at one stage, Kathleen corners me and she says, "Mary, you're my best friend and I love you. Now promise me you'll visit me in Birmingham." I will. "Ah, stop your old shite now," she says, and she pokes me hard in the arm. "I will," I says. "No, promise me," she says, and she pokes me even harder. And I promise. We swear devotion to each other. So before we finish, I practically promise to move with them the next day. And that me and Kathleen will always be best friends. And we'll rule the whole of Birmingham the way we did the convent school. And things will always be the way things always were. And that was that, a great send-off. I woke the next day and I felt like I was full of little holes. Or I was an amputee or something. Duck buttons. Me and Kathleen wrote to each other a few times. But sure, they were only boring old letters about gossip in the factory. Or who was riding who or who was dead. And sure, even after a while that had stopped. And I'd stopped throwing shot put at this point and started going out with Red O'Brien. When Kathleen came home at Christmas, she seemed a bit different, as if she was hiding something. Oh, she had some lovely clothes on her. I couldn't help feeling she was laughing at me behind my back. She couldn't believe I was going out with Red O'Brien. "Red O'Brien, Mary?" she asks. "Red O'Brien? Why?" We're both locked at this point and I says, "Why not?" I was getting a bit defensive now, like, "No, but what do you see in him, Mary? I mean, why?" And I think about it for a long time. And then finally I says, "Because he's a fucking howl," which was the truth. And then she breaks her shite laughing and then I break my shite laughing and we laugh for ages and ages and ages and I can't help feeling that we're laughing for totally different reasons. And then when things quieten down a bit, she asks me why I haven't visited her in Birmingham. We go through the hole, "You must, I will shite again," and she's gone for another year. After that, every time Kathleen came home at Christmas or for a funeral, we seemed that bit further apart. And her accent. It had become that horrible mongrel thing that Irish people get when they go over there. She started to use phrases like, "Oh, bless," which made her sound like a fucking idiot. She seemed older and sadder to me. Sure, I suppose I looked the same to her, but neither of us said anything to the other. And then one Christmas, Kathleen comes home and announces that her and Walter got married the previous Easter. I said I was delighted for her. Asked her all about it. And was it in a church, you old fucking pagan, you? And we laughed. But inside, I couldn't believe it. Not only that she hadn't used me as bridesmaid like we swore, or that she didn't invite me. She didn't even write to tell me. It made me feel very alone, I think. She only came home two more times after that, for her father's funeral and then for her mother's funeral. And sure, after that, there was nothing left for her to come back for. And then one night, it was shortly after her mother was buried, and we'd been drinking all day. I was completely bombed. Kathleen was doing much better than me. And I started trying to tell her about my duck buttons and how they sometimes make me feel sad when I think about them and what they had to do with her and all. She just can't stop laughing. She's trying to keep a straight face and occasionally she does quack noises and laughs all over again. And again, I try and tell her. And then finally, she puts her hand on my shoulder and she says, "Jesus, Mary, love, you really need to get out. See more of the world for yourself." And I flip and I call her old English whore. And Birmingham fucking hole, and I go for her, and I scratch, and I pull, and I punch, and when we're eventually separated, I have lumps of Kathleen's hair in my hands, and then Red brings me home, puts me to bed, and that's the last I ever see of her. I wonder if she heard about what happened between me and Red. I'd like to think that she didn't, because I reckon if she did, she'd have written me a letter. That's what I'd have done anyways. Maybe not. Kathleen. Next, the throwing of shot put. That might sound like a strange bit of secret history to have, but there were times when I was growing up when the throwing of shot put was the only bit of hope I had left to cling to. I'd always been good at pegging things. Even from an early age, I was always firing things around. Anything, really. Stones or ball bearings or dried cow shite or dead birds or whatever. And I had an ability to peg targets that bordered on the beautiful. Well, all small children have a trick which proud parents wheel out to show friends and relations when they're having a get-together. I mean, mostly it's singing with a bit of Irish dancing. Occasionally, it's some sort of body contortion, like double jointed elbows or eyelids that can be turned inside out or the like or whatever. Well, my trick was an ability to hit small targets with even smaller stones at almost impossible distances. And I cleaned out almost any fairground that came within an ass's roar of the town. They used to dread me coming. And I'd more oversized, understuffed panda bears than it was healthy for one girl to have. I was just an expert in the pegging department. And I could make stones do almost anything I wanted. Raise sparks or skim across lakes like they weighed nothing or about to take off. Or break windows in the convent or whatever. Dangerous. It was also one of the only ways I had of getting some attention off my father. It almost even made us closer for a while even. I mesmerised him with stones. And my father wasn't a bad old bastard, really, all told. Only disappointed by life he was, and with a near total inability to communicate with children. Not exactly classical parenting skills, I'll admit, but he was never bad or violent. Which is news enough in the townland where I came from. People almost liked him. Nearly. Only wrapped up in himself he was, and full of fears. And as he grew older, he kind of just disappeared from us all entirely. He climbed into himself. I'd watch him there sometimes, sitting in the parlour, silent. Thinking, maybe. About what none of us would ever know. Ah, about nothing, maybe. I was the last of the four girls. An afterthought, my mother said, and they'd only gone again if truth be known on the off chance of producing a boy. Oh, that would have meant the world to him, she thought. Might have given them some new lease of life or other, might have drawn him out of himself. He'd even gone and picked out a name in the unlikely event of his prayers being answered. Jarlett. I'd have been called if things had worked out. Jarlett. Like I said, he was small in his outlook. But anyways, when I was about 11 or 12, when I wasn't terrorising nuns or maiming small animals, I took to strolling out with himself of an evening. Well, it was a ritual of his in them days to saunter the town after his tea. And my mother used to push me into joining him. I think she was worried that he might be trampled by something or might just disappear. And so I'd be sent folly after my duffel coat and say nothing. Around by the edge of town just, through the copse, past the sewage plant and then down by the Bishop's Field. And though we stayed silent, and though he mostly stayed about 10 paces ahead of me, became a sort of an intimacy in itself. And it was here that my prodigious talents in the pitching department unwittingly revealed itself to him. I'd watch him watching me in a sort of confused wonder as I pelted stones around like a body possessed, and it felt like... it felt good, like. So, someone in the town must have been saying something about me somewhere, because the next thing, Mr. Dilger lands up and asks, would they ever send me down to the Marion Athletics Club to train in the bit of track and field? He said it was known around town what a strong girl I was and that people had been remarking on my ability to peg stones, and wouldn't it be great if we could channel a bit of that exuberance into the javelin or the shot put or whatever, and we'd be going for gold, as Mr. Dilger said, and besides, wouldn't it keep me off the streets? I reckon it was the nuns that sent him. And then there'd be girls my own age down there, and I could do the bit of running and jumping too, and there'd be tournaments to go to, and trials for this and that, and the community games then in Mosney. Just the way he said it. Mosney. It just made it sound so beautiful and mysterious. Like a cross between Mecca and Disney. And once my mother was assured that it wasn't going to cost a penny, the main old shite, she was all for it. And it was decided that I'd head down there the following Thursday. Even my father seemed happy at the prospect, and he smiled at me strange. It almost unnerved me. Ah, oh, the Marion Athletics Club now. We're nothing, if not consistent. In their entire sorry history, they'd never won nothing, and were unlikely to ever win anything either. Unless, of course, they got given a free pass into the Special Olympics. And even then, they'd have been given a run for their money. So I went down to training. And I quickly worked out that the only people down there were the rejects from the brass band and the slightly criminally inclined. That most of them looked like extras from a campaign ad for polio prevention. So I kept to myself. Tried my best anyway. Running and the high jump and the long jump and the hurdles and the javelin. And I took to track and field like a pig to shite. And I was a natural, Mr. Dilger said. But my most especial skills lay in the shot put department. I took to that like some East German Helga, and I loved it. Some nights then when I'd be down a train and like thrown or that, catch a glimpse of my father watching from the sidelines unannounced. And even though he'd never remark after, I knew he was proud of me or something. Well, surprised at any rate. And most of my blind rages had begun to abate, and that made him happy. And then walking home at night, he'd say small things to me like he'd never done before. I mean, boring shit now, like commenting on the cold or the length of the days. But it was something. So, we're all geared enough for the community games, and talk is all about glory for the town and putting the Marion Club on the map and bringing home the medals. And for the first time ever, I felt there was a destination in life. And even though I still felt like as if I was between two stops, as it were, well, at least I had direction. And it was a better feeling than feeling I was wandering around in the wilderness the whole time. So things hotted up over the summer. And we talked about not only the community games and what would happen. And we went to trial after trial. And even though I was young and I had no expectations or nothing, I qualified. When I told my father, he almost looked present. And he stood up and he said simply,
"Good girl, Mary.
Good girl, Mary." That nearly did for me, that did. And I decided then and there I'd win something for him. So we counted down the days. And much to everyone's surprise, he decided to come with me. So we borrowed the uncle's Hillman Hunter for the weekend and off we went. And Mosny. Now Mosny. Well, words wouldn't do it justice. Millions of people, it felt like, in culottes and singlets. Grass and tannies and shellies and chips everywhere. And there was no pressure from him now, nor nothing.
Just do your
best,
Mary.
Just do your best, Mary, was all he said. And my competition starts. Only dawns on me pretty quick as I watch the other girls that most of them have a good year in me, or a year and a half. They're all big, hefty girls now, camogie ties everywhere. And it's clear to me I'm not going to win gold. And I'm not going to win silver neither. And it's a major battle for bronze between me and another girl called Annette Coleman from Boris. She's one of the biggest, ugliest things I've ever seen. And it's getting near the end and I'm edgy as all hell and all I can think about is winning the stupid bastard and thing for himself. I want it. So I line up my last throw. And I pelt it for me for all my worth. And it lands. And it's fairly all right, like. Only Annette Coleman bests it then, and that was that. And I can't face himself, I can't. Back in the dressing rooms of my own, all graffiti on the walls and the high windows broken. And I realise for the first time what defeat smells like. It smells like old sweat and dead grass. Something had been taken off me. I start to feel this fire in my belly. And I feel it rise up in me and I let it go and it pours out my mouth like a growl. And it fills my eyes with spots of colour and bright flashes and this heat roaring through me and I'm up on my feet. And I'm racing across the field to where Annette Coleman is still leaping up and down to fucking Egypt. And it must have only taken me a few seconds to get to her and she stopped jumping now and she's saying something to me and she's looking at me strange and she's saying something but I can't hear her even though I'm right close. And then I just draw back my head and I plant her one right on the bridge of the nose and I hear a crack and she goes down. Then suddenly all hell breaks loose. There's blood all over her singlet. I'm trying to say, "I'm sorry." And that was that. And my father watching. He never spoke to me again after that. Or if he did, it was nothing of consequence. And I stopped going down the Marion. I just went back to menacing the town like before and he crawled back into himself and he was dead not long after. So there you go. Give a girl enough hope and she'll hang herself. Now, to the last bit of my history. Red O'Brien. It was no fair wind that brought us together. Only a sort of retarded inevitability. Before I'd hardly said two sentences to Red O'Brien, I'd already poked him with all the strength I could muster on the bony part of his shoulder. I'd say his arm was dead for days. You see, I'd begun to hear people around town refer to me as Mary Motorhead. So me and Kathleen set about finding out where it came from. And the trail led to Red. All 5 foot nothing. And from the moment I saw him, I just knew. There was something there. And it had nothing to do with his looks or anything. I mean, there he was, low to the ground and hairy. And a pair of tan slacks that he'd shoehorned himself into and left nothing to their imagination. Leaning against the wall with a bunch of other Latchikos. Refugees from something. Nothing. Mad. So me and Kathleen marches up to him and I says, "Are you going around calling me Mary Motorhead?" "I am," says he, and he's smiling like a bastard, looking right at me. I'm smiling too at this stage. I don't know why. And I says, "Well, let me hear you do it one more time and I'll burst your bulb." And I give him the dead arm. And he keeps looking. And I see it all. All my secret history and all his secret history laid out before. Stretching into the future like through the lens of a camera. Then me and Kathleen walks away and she says, "He's an awful fucking idiot." I said, "You can sing that." Because it was the truth. But not all the truth. And then Kathleen goes to Birmingham. And I'm not down the Marion anymore. And when I'm not working, I wander the town. And occasionally, I find myself perched on a wall alongside Red. Killing ants with me finger and talking shite. And honest to God, he made me laugh me arse off. And he had this look in his eyes. As if he'd just been shot from a cannon and was looking round for someone to land on top of. And pretty soon I knew that was me. So then I suppose I was going out with him. We walked the town together like two cripples holding each other up, skirting the periphery. Early and late, light and darkness. We throw stones in the dirty river and watch fog pour off its back. We'd look in shop windows and we talked about everyone in town and took the piss out of them. We'd roll about together some days and laugh. Some days we were silent. Never said a word to each other, only afraid to leave each other's sides. And then one day I woke up and I knew I loved him. And I tried hatefulness and cruelty and the odd few rocks to chase him away like you would a small dog. But he stayed loyal. And then I made one last bid for freedom. It was the Sunday of the big fair. We'd all drank all weekend and there was dancing and laughing and shouting and me and Red left the crowd to get chips. And we walked down the main street and Red puts his hand into the back pocket of my jeans to get a feel of me arse like. And I don't know, but I felt like I was about to burst or that I'd cry me eyes out. I needed Red and I was scared I'd hurt him. Before I know it, I'm shouting at him, calling him a hairy dwarf all Egypt. And people are kind of laughing and I says, "It's all off and that's that. And if I'd been stronger, that would have been an end to it." But I was lost. And then the dance the following week, blue slacks this time, we fell together and that was that windmills. Oh, it's a funny old institution, really, marriage. Well, in theory, you spend a few years trying out various partners. And when you find the one you really love, you marry them. And then you spend the rest of your days making their life as miserable as possible. You see, I reckon you should marry the person you hate the most. At least that way you could enjoy the bit where you get to fuck up their lives. Too late for that. And all the time leading up to the wedding, through the torrents of rain and darkness that was that summer, Red could see that I was nervous or jumpy or something. He kept saying, "It'll be all right, Mary. You'll see. And I've a big surprise for our wedding night." And I says, "Red, we done it already. There was nothing big about it." And it came as no surprise to me. And we laughed. And he explains that he's got a special surprise for us, a honeymoon, and it's all booked and I find out on the day. So as we stumble towards the wedding, I'm all the time wondering where we're off to. And I'm thinking, either the Isle of Man or Birmingham to visit Kathleen and Walter. I thought for a while maybe London, but realised pretty quick that Red's imagination just didn't stretch that far. And so we got hitched and we lost a deposit on the hotel because of the fighting. I'm sick as a pig the next day and we head off. Do you know where he took me? Portlaoise for 4 days. Some friend of his aunt's at a B&B there, and I don't know what was wrong at Portlaoise at the time, but I'd never seen so many roadworks into one place. It was as if they'd dug up the whole fucking town on our behalf, or as if they'd lost something. Holes and cages and the smell of raw sewage, and I was happy. I don't think I stopped laughing the whole time I was there, even. I love Red so much it hurt. And I was as near to happiness as made no differ. So then we came home, moved into the house and got on with it. And things were like they were before, only instead of walking the town, we watched telly, and instead of fairgrounds, we went to the pub. Fairgrounds aren't for married couples, apparently. And things were great for a while. And things were super in the riding department, which is very important. No problems there. But something changed. We stopped believing each other, I think. Or I did at any rate. And I was afraid he was drifting away from me. I stopped believing in him or believing that he was actually there. And so I'd slap him a bit or rise him until I got a response of fuck off. And that was fine because at least then I knew the other was there. Red was there. And then that became habit. And it grew and it grew and it became our relationship. Needling. And aggression and cruelty and violence. And the more it went on, the more we had to withdraw into ourselves, and the more we withdrew into ourselves, the harder we had to try to get that response that we needed. I suppose all we ever wanted was to tell each other how much we loved. To tell him how lost I was and how scared and how I needed him here. Present. And all there was drunken screams and clenched fists and mental cruelty. And then it happened. We'd gotten so far apart and so wild with despair that I tried to kill him. I tried to stab him through the top of the head. I tried to crack him open to see if he was in there, to see if I was in there. And that was the end of that. People often ask me if I regret doing it. My answer to that is yes and no. Yes, of course I regret hurting him. Red. But seeing him with all the fun squeezed out of him and every bit of goodness in him bruised on account of me, well, in a way, it was an act of mercy. I was setting him free. And anyway, it was inevitable. I saw it years ago. There was no choice. And that's that. My secret history. Makes no sense, does it? I sometimes wonder if the judge would have given me a different sentence if he'd known my real story. Because all I was allowed to say in court was yes. Or no. So that's no answer to anything. Would he felt sorry or something? Understood it better? I reckon not. And he'd be right. Anyways, to tell the truth, I like it here. I have my place, and I'm here for a reason. So I'm going to do my time, and I'll do my courses. And when I get out, I'll just disappear. Float away. And I won't ever go back to that place or see those old faces again. And I won't ever see Red again. It wouldn't be fair. He suffered enough. We're free. We're free.